From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Emily Dickinson once said, "If I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. These are the only ways I know it. Is there any other way?" This hour, we're going to talk with poets. We're going to hear poems read out loud. There's a reason Plato argued that poets would be banished from the ideal republic. Poetry is powerful. Poetry has grace. Those distilled, compact words are dense with meaning. They're words, as T.S. Eliot put it, that purify the dialect of the tribe. Patricia Smith is one poet whose heart pulses with the power of words. She's the four-time champion of the National Poetry Slam, the competition's most successful poet. Her book, Blood Dazzler, was nominated for the 2008 National Book Award. She joined Steve Paulson in our studios in Madison, Wisconsin, to speak about the power of poetry. And you should be warned that Patricia Smith's poetry uses provocative language and imagery that some of you will find offensive.
I start all my readings out with the same poem, and I've been doing that for, I was going to say 10 years, but it's been longer than that. A while ago, I started doing a residency in a grade school in Miami, working with a group of sixth graders. And the first time I went to the school, I came bounding in saying, "Well, I'm here to teach you poetry," but the area that I was in had a very, very high incidence of drug use. So a lot of the kids had lost parents or brothers and sisters to AIDS. And, you know, I come in with my poetry and they're all kind of sitting back in their seats looking at me saying, "Well, how can you make my life better?" And there was a little girl there named Nicole, and Nicole's mom had just died. And because Nicole was now living with her grandmother, and her grandmother really didn't have any resources for her, you know, there were no psychologists flying in. You know, there was no place she could take Nicole to have Nicole heal emotionally, so she put her back in school. She was already there. And she wanted me to teach her to write a poem about her mother. Now, the buzz about her mother, who had been a drug addict, was that she was a drug addict. And Nicole didn't want to write about that. She wanted to write about, "Well, my mother used to sing when she braided my hair." And what she was asking me to help her do, although I didn't see it that way at the time, was give her something that was going to take her from one place in her head to a safer place. And that's what I think the words and the language can do. Unfortunately, you know, when you start writing poetry, it's like having a second throat. And some of us go through our whole lives not knowing that that throat is there. But once you discover it, and I went through that whole thing where poetry was a, you know, recreational exercise and a big social occasion for me. But when you realize that you have people like that and all it takes is a certain group of words arranged in a certain way, and then they walk away from that living their life in a different way or thinking differently about their lives. So
you think a poem can do that?
A poem can definitely, definitely do that. And that's when I can pick points in my poetry career where I realized that I had a real responsibility and that I was wielding real power. And I had to be careful with that.
Hmm. Now, you said that there's one poem that you always read when you visit schools. What's the poem?
It's called Building Nicole's Mama. It's the first poem in the Tea House book.
Could you read that?
Sure. Sure. I could do it. I have to say that it's for the sixth grade class at Lily C. Evans Elementary School in Dade County, Miami, because they made me promise, and this is like 12 years ago, to say it every time I did the poem. And I think all kind of things are going to happen if I screw that up, so I do. "I am astonished at their mouthful names. Lacanicia, Chevalane, Deleo, Fumaleo. Their ragged rebellions and lip gloss pouts and all those pants drooped as drapery. I rejoice when they kiss my face, whisper wet and urgent in my ear, make me their obsession because I have brought them poetry. They shout me raw, bruise my wrist with their pulling, and brashly claim me as mama as they cradle my head in their little laps, waiting for new words to grow in my mouth. You, you, you. Angry, jubilant, weeping poets, we are all saviors, reluctant hosannas in the limelight. But you knew that, didn't you? So let us bless this sixth grade class. 40 cracking voices, 40 nappy heads, and all of them raise their hands when I ask. They have all seen the Reaper, grim in his heavy robe, pushing the button for the dead project elevator, begging for a break at the corner pawn shop, cackling wildly in the back pew of the Baptist church. I ask the death question, and 40 fists punch the air. Me! Me! An O'Neill matchstick crack child watched his mother's body become a claw. And 9-year-old Tico Jefferson, barely big enough to lift the gun, fired a bullet into his throat when Mama bended his back with a lead pipe. Tamika cried into a sofa pillow when Daddy blasted Mama into the north wall of their cluttered one-room apartment. Danya's cousin, gone in a drive-by, dark window, click, click, gone, says Danya, her tiny finger a barrel, the thumb a hammer. I am astonished at their losses. And yet when I read a poem about my own hard-eyed teenager, Jeffrey asks, is he dead yet? Cannot be comprehended. My 18-year-old still pushing and pulling his own breath. And 40 faces pity me, knowing that I will soon be as they are, numb to our bloodied histories, favoring the Reaper with a thumbs up and a wink, hearing the question and shouting, me! Me, Miss Smith, I know somebody dead. Can poetry hurt us, they ask me, before crawling into my words to sleep. I love you, Nicole says. Nicole wearing my face, pimples peppering her nose, and she is as black as angels are. Nicole's braids kissed with match flame to seal them. And can you teach me to write a poem about my mama, Miss Smith? I mean, you write about your daddy, and he dead. Can you teach me to remember my mama? A teacher tells me this is the first time Nicole has admitted that her mother is gone. Murdered by slim silver needles and a stranger rifling through her blood, the virus pushing her skeleton through for Nicole to see. And now this child with rusty knees and mismatched shoes sees poetry as her scream and asks me for the words to build her mother again. Replacing the voice, stitching on the lost flesh. So poets, as we take the stage, as we flirt and sin and rejoice behind microphones, remember Nicole. She knows that we are here now, and she is an empty vessel waiting to be filled. And she is waiting. And she's waiting. And she waits.
Wow. You know, one of the things that's so interesting about a lot of your poems is that you can take on completely different personas, and it can be really powerful. I'm thinking, for instance, about your poem Skinhead, and it's worth pointing out that you are an African-American woman, and you were telling this poem from the perspective of a skinhead. And I should also say that, just as a word of warning to our listeners, there is some very strong language in this poem.
I'll just tell you just a little tiny bit. Someone painted a swastika on Plymouth Rock. And if you've ever lived in New England or anywhere near New England, you know there's certain things you don't mess with, and the rock is one of them. So they went out looking for whoever had done it, and they never found the exact person, but they traced it to this group called the White Youth League. And they interviewed a representative of this group who was spewing all this hatred, blacks, Jews, gays, I hate everybody. And I thought about how easy it would be to just say, oh, what an idiot, and dismiss this person. On the other hand, I thought he and I started at the same place. For some reason, he veered off in one direction, I veered off in the other. And this poem was an attempt to bring us back to center. They call me skinhead, and I got my own beauty. It is knife scrawled across my back in sore, jagged letters. It is in the way my eyes snap away from the obvious. I sit in my dim matchbox on the edge of a bed tousled with my ragged smell, slide razors across my hair, count how many ways I can bring blood closer to the surface of my skin. These are the duties of the righteous, the ways of the anointed. The face that moves in my mirror is huge and pockmarked, apple-cheeked, scraped pink and brilliant. I am filled with my own spit. 2 years ago, a machine that slices leather sucked in my hand and held it, whacking off 3 fingers at the root. I didn't feel nothing until I looked down and saw them on the floor next to my boot heel, and I ain't worked since then. I sit here and watch niggers take over my TV set. Walking like kings up and down the sidewalks in my head, walking like their fat black mamas named them freedom, while my shoulders tell me that ain't right. So I move out into the sun, where my beauty makes them lower their heads, or into the night with a lead pipe up my sleeve or razor in my boot. I was born to make things right. It's easy now to bend my big body into shadows, to move from a place where there was nothing into the stark circle of a streetlight, the pipe raised up high over my head. It's a kick to watch their eyes get big, round and gleaming like cartoon jungle boys, just in that second before they know the pipe's gonna come down. And I got this thing I like to say. Hey, listen to this. I like to say, hey, nigger, Abe Lincoln's been dead a long time. I get hard listening to their skin burst. I was born to make things right. Then this reporter comes around. Seems I was a little sloppy kicking some fag's ass, and he opens up and screams about it. So this reporter finds me at home in bed, the TV flashes, licking my face clean. Same old shit. I ain't got no job, the coloreds and spicks got 'em. Why ain't I working? Look at my hand. No, I'm not part of no organized group. I'm just a white boy who loves his race, fighting for a pure country. Sometimes it's just me, sometimes 3, sometimes 30. AIDS will take care of the faggots. Then it's going to be white on black in the streets. Then there'll be 3 million. I tell him that. So he writes it up, and I come off looking like I'm some kind of freak, like I'm Hitler himself. I ain't that lucky, but I got my own beauty. It's in my steel-toed boots, in the hard corners of my shaved head. I look in the mirror, and I hold up my mangled hand. Only the baby finger left. I know it's the wrong finger, but f*** you all anyway. I'm riding the top rung of the perfect race, my face scraped pink and brilliant. I'm your baby, America, your boy. Drunk on my own spit, I am beautiful. And I was born and raised right here.
Your poem, Skinhead. I mean, obviously you're describing someone truly repellent here, but am I wrong to note a sense of some empathy for this person as well?
No. I mean, yeah, you're wrong. It's not that. It's me inhabiting him saying this is my story. It could have been a different story. I could have 25 different stories, 25 different skinheads. This is my particular story. Now, it's up to you when you hear it and it's done, whether or not you're going to continue to think, oh, you know, what an idiot, I hate him. Or if you're going to begin to think, not I feel sorry for him, but let me think as a writer and as a thinking person how many different directions we come from and how small the turn has to be to get us to veer crazily off somewhere. And I think thinking of it that way helps any creative person. Anyone, because I can't, in all honesty, I can't dismiss 3/4 of the population because they're people that I find repulsive, not when I sit down to write. But I did this poem over and over and over again. And then at one stage, I started having my eyes closed during the whole poem. And I would open my eyes and I'd be like 5 feet away from the microphone. I have no idea how I worked my way over there. But another thing started to happen. The skinhead started to get an accent or a way of saying certain words that I would never say. And I do believe that if you're open to a persona long enough, the persona will begin to tell you what it wants to be. You hear people who write, you know, novels say, I started the novel with no idea where it was going to go. I mean, eventually every character in that novel begins to move and speak the way that they want to speak, and they lead the writer. It kind of sounds mystical, but mm-hmm. I don't think it really is, because I worked in persona a lot, and you do tend to, if you're doing it correctly, you lose a little bit of yourself in the persona. And what people tell me about this is, first of all, it's visually strange because you have a black woman and this voice is coming out and is telling this decidedly non-black story, but also that they can every once in a while see flickers of this guy. I mean, really see him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's both the appeal and the danger of persona. I do think you can invest yourself too much in it.
Patricia Smith is the 4-time winner of the National Poetry Slam. Her book, called Blood Dazzler, has been nominated for the 2008 National Book Award. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Coming up next, why poetry matters today.
If you're not trained in poetry, you're not safe to be let loose in the world. You know? And I think that's true, you know. And I always think, you know, George Bush was not safe to be let loose in the world, because when he bungled that metaphor, war on terror, I think he did a lot of damage because it confused people. People stopped thinking poetically.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Jay Perini teaches poetry at Middlebury College. He's written several volumes of poetry, as well as numerous anthologies and books of criticism. His latest is called Why Poetry Matters, which is odd, since the book starts with the sentence, "Poetry doesn't matter to most people. That is, most people don't write it, don't read it, and don't have any idea why anybody would spend valuable time doing such a thing." So I asked him, does poetry matter?
Well, just 3 days ago, I went to an elementary school in Ripton, Vermont, and the kids had been well prepared for me. Robert Frost lived nearby when he was living, and the kids had been asked to memorize a poem by Frost. And I was really startled by how transformed these kids were by the language and how excited they were by it. My feeling is that poems are little engines of language that have been beautifully tuned. And so the language reflects and digs into reality in ways that have a kind of spiritual effect on the listener, the reader, the speaker. I mean, poems dig into the mind. I still remember the time when I was about 18 years old, and I picked up a volume of poems by Gerard Manley Hopkins. And I read this little poem called Spring and Fall to a young child. And I still remember feeling like my entire day I was trembling all day long, because this poem explains something to me about reality that I hadn't understood before. I can say this poem from memory. Shall I try that?
Yes, would you please?
Margaret, are you grieving over golden groves on leaving? Leaves, like the things of man, you with your fresh thoughts care for. Can you? Ah, as the heart grows older, It will come to such sights colder by and by, nor spare a sigh, though worlds of wanwood leaf meal lie. And yet you will weep and know why. Sorrow's springs are the same. Nor mouth had, no, nor mind expressed, what heart heard of, ghost guessed. It is the blight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for. You know, you come across a line like, the worlds of wanwood leaf meal lie, and you see a poet of genius kind of going crazy, going wild. And there's this wild energy in poetry, which is then focused. It's like you take a magnifying glass and put the sun to it and let that little beam go down there on the page. It burns a hole in the page. A great poem burns a hole in the page. And then when you read it, it burns a hole in your mind.
Language isn't simple for you once you've discovered poetry, is it?
Well, no, because you're also then horrified by the kind of language you hear sometimes on the radio and the television. You know, it's very difficult to listen to this bad language. I mean, I always think of that, again, going back to Frost, that line that if you're not trained in poetry, you're not safe to be let loose in the world. You know? And I think that's true, you know. And I always think, you know, George Bush was not safe to be let loose in the world, because when he bungled that metaphor, war on terror, I think he did a lot of damage because it confused people. People stopped thinking poetically, and they began to get very confused in their thinking. Frost said, you have to know how far you can go with a metaphor and where the metaphor breaks down.
What is it he said? Unless you're at home in the metaphor, you're not safe anywhere?
You're not safe anywhere. You're not safe to be let loose in the world.
What is poetry now? You talk about teaching Robert Frost to middle schoolers. What about rap poetry? What about lyrics to songs? What about Bob Dylan and an earlier generation? Is that poetry as well?
You know, I was driving down the road just a few weeks ago, and Bob Dylan's Dream, that old song, came on the radio, and I thought, oh, you know, I was moved to tears, you know, Bob Dylan's Dream, you know. While riding on train going west, I fell asleep for to take my rest. I dreamed a dream that made me sad concerning myself and the last few or the first few friends I had. I thought, you know, that is absolute perfection. We've all had this terrible sadness because we remember how when we were 17, 16, 18, and this little cohort of friends that we loved, small group, were breaking up, we're sitting around a campfire, and we know we're going our own ways forever. And he says, I'd give $1 million at the drop of a hat just to go back for a moment and be with those friends and to repossess that moment of late childhood, late adolescence. And I thought, well, this is perfection. This is poetry. And for some academic to come along and say, oh, this is just pop music, is crazy. I mean, this is this language in Bob Dylan and so many other singers, you know, operates on a zillion levels and in many ways participates in the great traditions of poetry.
Well, we were talking at the very beginning, at least, about why poetry matters. I guess you've answered it in a way, and the answer doesn't necessarily involve poetry in the traditional sense. It's poetry as it comes from and to the people.
Exactly. It's also language that people can think they can live without poetry. I would argue that, in fact, their life is infinitely poorer if they don't have poetry. Because, first of all, there's wisdom in poetry. You look at all the violence going on, you know. You see, I was just looking at, you know, last night and seeing that some Palestinians had, you know, blown up somebody somewhere. And I thought of those great lines, September 1st, 1939, a poem that after 9/11 was read over and over and over again on the radio. W.H. Auden's really great poem about that moment when the Germans invaded Poland. September 1st, 1939, and the world was set into chaos. You know, from that very moment, think of it, 60 million people died in World War II. 60 million. In that poem, there's just a few lines that I love in that poem. He says, I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Well, wow, it's rhymed, it's simple, but it gets to the horrifying truth of contemporary world affairs. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. I think Auden had a peculiarly fine understanding of politics, society, government, and the terrors of tyranny, because he lived through the heart of the 20th century, especially the 30s and 40s, when there was so much destruction going on in the world. And he wrote this poem called Epitaph on a Tyrant. He writes, "Perfection of a kind was what he was after. And the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He knew human folly like the back of his hand and was greatly interested in armies and fleets. When he laughed, respectable senators burst with laughter. And when he cried, the little children died in the streets."
Wow.
I mean, that's a pretty powerful understanding of tyranny and autocracy, you know, and how the senators go along and laugh with the dictator when he's laughing, and how when the dictator is not happy, children die in the streets.
In the world we live in, what if language isn't enough?
Well, it would be crazy to suggest that poetry can change the world's ills. As W.H. Auden says in his elegy for W.B. Yeats, poetry makes nothing happen. I think it's been probably very rare for a poem to have actually stopped an army from marching into another country. A poem can't stop the progress of cancer. It can't stop a disease. A poem probably rarely will stop one friend from saying something injurious to another friend. All of these terrible little things, these fissures in society, these cracks in the teacup, which widen into huge gaps and take us into the vast caverns of death and ultimate silence, will always occur. Poetry is simply one of the places we go for refuge. You know, it's always inadequate. It's one of the sadnesses of language. And I think one of its poignant aspects is the fact that poetry is always inadequate. It gestures in the direction of silence, but it can't really take us there. It just points toward.
Jay Perini teaches poetry at Middlebury College. He's the author of Why Poetry Matters. The poet Gioia Timpanelli has been doing something different lately. She's been writing prose, novels. But her novels can't escape poetic sensibilities. They're almost epic poems. Timpanelli's latest is no exception. It's a novel called What Makes a Child Lucky. It's a story of hunger set in rural Sicily about a boy named Joseph. Joseph experiences the brutal killing of his best friend. And after being tricked by his brothers, Joseph ends up being kidnapped by the murderers. But Joseph finds mercy and kindness in Immaculata, the old woman who cooks for the murderers. Gioia Timpanelli told Anne Strainchamps about the novel and about the differences between being a poet and a novelist.
Well, it's interesting. I call myself secretly a poet. In other words, even my poetry is prose poem. Nature itself, as a child, was my poetry. Oh, there was this great pine tree outside the house in Northwest Connecticut where my family went. And I used to go to this old tree, a huge pine, and I was in awe of it. I just loved it. And I used to make stories up around it. I used to look at it. I cared about it a great deal. And this was another part of my life. And I'd say that poetry was also part of that, that there was something in that. I used to write songs to my cats and my big black cat, my grandmother's cat, really, but mine too. I was just a little kid. And that inspired me tremendously, all beings, like creatures. And I don't know, but poetry was associated as well with that.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that no matter what you write with a deep kind of poetic sensibility, whether it comes out in the actual form of a novel or a short story or a poem.
I think that's probably true. I never thought of it in exactly that way, but I know that that's true.
Well, the writing in this particular book is so lyrical. I wanted to ask you to read just a passage to give us a taste from the very beginning. What makes a child lucky?
Okay, let me see. Sicily. At the end of the 19th century, or any place at any time. Hunger, she said, is very personal. At first, it even tricks you into feeling guilty over your own misery. Guilty for your human lack of grace. It holds your wrists tightly in its bony fingers. It breathes its foul breath into your gaping mouth as you sleep. But wait, we said. Doesn't this happen in a story Ovid tells about Erisichthon's hunger? What does it have to do with now? It's an old story. True, true, she said. But why do you insist on being literal to time? You see, time might change the details, but the story of greed and retribution, or as you moderns insist, of cause and effect, is essentially the same. Erisichthon starves in his soul as well as his stomach. Why do you believe hunger could never happen to you, not where you are, and not now among your people? You think you're too well off for hunger to find you? Ah, my friends, we thought exactly the same.
Oh, that's such a chilling beginning to the book. And you know, until I read it, it had not really occurred to me how many old fairy tales and folk tales have hunger at their core. I mean, think about it, Hansel and Gretel, Jack and the Beanstalk, the old Sicilian story you're working with for this book.
I think the ancestors gave us stories also about a time when people were indeed hungry, as they are all over the world now, right now, to this day, children and people hungry. And our ancestors gave us stories about times that were lean. And we have a full spectrum of human experience in these old stories, these humble old stories, so that you find when there's something at the beginning that's missing, the story in its rich, generous way will come back and give us something that feeds the real child, that continues to make the story at the end find what was missing or lost at the beginning.
I love that story as a kind of food.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true, too. That's true.
You know, this is a story set in Italy, set in Sicily, so of course food is central, as it is in Italian culture. But it's not just food. It's the way food and landscape are kind of woven together. So there's a passage, yes, I wanted to ask you to read where your hero, this young boy, has gone off to the wilderness, and he's living there with a bunch of bandits under the supervision of the one woman in this group, this kind of mysterious woman. And there's a little lull in the action, a kind of lyrical morning, when the boy goes out to gather some wild asparagus on the mountainside. I wondered, mm-hmm, if you could read that section.
Oh, yes. I spent hours searching for wild asparagus up in the mountain meadows, climbing higher and higher. The beautiful Sicilian spring day made me feel drunk. In the middle of the highest field, I picked a few stalks, and just as I was adding the last to my collection, I heard the scattered tinkling of sheep bells. And then from someplace, I heard a whistling sound, a shepherd's pipe. I followed the music until I saw the shepherd playing his pipe, sitting on an outcropping below, his back to me. I walked out of sight and lay on the blessed ground, and for the longest time, I listened to the music. I can't tell you how long I stayed there, for time was lost, and when suddenly the music stopped, I heard a great rush of that tling, tling, tlinging of tiny sheep bells, and I finally stood up to see below the shepherd and his flock, a vast crowd now moving quickly down the mountain.
Oh, that's gorgeous, and funny that passage you just read kind of connects really strongly to the last section I just wanted to ask you about, just because I think it's so lovely. There's a moment when Immaculata looks, the boy is going away, and he asks her to bless him. And she does, but all she does is looks at him. Could you, mm-hmm, read the passage where he describes that look?
Okay, let's see. Okay. When I got a few feet away, I turned to wave, but instead I surprised myself and called out, "Bless me, Immaculata." She looked indifferently at me for a long minute, as though she were composing herself. Then her entire face changed, and without hesitation, she looked right into my eyes with the most compassionate look I have ever seen in my life. No one had ever looked at me like that before. It was powerful, and it lasted a long time, or that's how it felt. When that look of great feeling, of a large caring, went through me, I felt a kind of well-being surrounding me. Before this moment, I had only understood that word compassion in terms of deeds and actions. Deeds and actions I understood, but a look that could change you? Another strange thing was that this intense look did not exactly come from Immaculata. As soon as I felt it, I knew that someone or something that was extraordinary had put eyes to a vast source, maybe some great heart, and had looked at me. Whatever it was, I now knew that there could be such a thing. She gave me that blessing before she turned, and without another word disappeared into the farmhouse. That was the last time I saw Immaculata.
I love that passage. I don't entirely know why I love that passage so much. I think it's something about the boy's sense of something so much greater and larger coming through this woman's eyes. And maybe this is really reaching, but I wonder whether that's part of what you were talking about in terms of how a poet feels about the language, you know, that there's so much embedded in every single word and coming through the words you use.
Yes. You know, oh, that's really so. I write in images, right? I see the story, but then I hear it. I always pass it through my ear. There's no other way I could write anything without my ear being the real arbiter.
Poet Gioia Timpanelli's novel is called What Makes a Child Lucky, and Strangechamp spoke with her. Coming up next, the Australian poet Les Murray.
The averted. The one whose eyes do not meet yours is alone at heart and looks where the dead look for an ally in his cause.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
I was upstaged in Nottingham, after reading poetry there, by what lay in the porter's room above.
Les Murray reading his poem Postmortem.
Ginger human skeletons, 8 of them. Disturbed by extensions to the Arts Centre and reassembled from the dozer's shove, some might have been my ancestors, Nottingham being where my mother's people fled from in the English Civil War. These were older than that migration, crusty little roundheads of sleep, stick bundles half burned to clay by water. Their personhoods had gone into the body of that promise preached to them. What had stayed in their bones were their diseases, the marks of labour in a rope-furrowed shoulder blade, their ages when they died and what they'd eaten. Bread, bacon, beer, cheese, apples, greens. No tomato atoms in them, no potato ends. No coffee yet, or tea, or aspirin. But alcoholic curds, horn-spooned at a fair, an opium physic and peas porridge. The thought that in some cells their programs might persist, my far parentage, attracted me no more than rebuilding faces for them with wire and moulding. Unsatisfied to go as a detective to the past, I want the past live, with the body we have in the promise, that book which opens when the story ends. Being even a sound modern physique is like owning an apartment in Venice.
Australian poet Les Murray, reading his poem Postmortem. Murray is considered by many literary critics to be the greatest poet in the English language today. Steve Paulson sat down with Les Murray for a very rare interview.
You obviously have a tremendous store of knowledge about literature and poetry in particular, but I read somewhere that you have not wanted to read certain revered poets in the British canon, for instance, John Keats. Is that true?
That was true in school. School's a fair while ago. Now, the reason was that it was completely irrelevant to our life. I mean, there I was, a country kid in a country town high school in the 20th century, being told to read a poetry that came out of the end of the 18th century in England, a totally different world. I mean, leaves fell off trees in that world, for God's sake, in autumn. And it was completely irrelevant to us, and we took no notice of it. And then our English teacher pointed us to a certain modern poetry, English poetry of the 1930s, and the sportsmaster, for heaven's sake, turned me on to Australian modern poetry, which I hadn't known existed. And there was some good Australian modern poetry whom I started reading, and I thought, yeah, this is relevant. This belongs to the country and the age I live in. So I got interested.
Now, you've described yourself in various things that I've read about you as being most at home among the poor white people of Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, you come from a humble background, right?
Poor people, yeah, not humble. The border Scots have never been humble in the history of the world, but they I give you Richard Nixon. But they have been occasionally poor. They've often been poor. You know, the Scots are supposed to be mean. It's largely because they're poor.
So you were poor as you were growing up?
Yeah, and my grandfather actually kept my father poor. It was because of a terrible kind of battle between them over who was the better bushman of the two. You know, had the better developed sort of forestry knowledge and timber cutting ability and so on. And then also my parents were terribly unlucky. They had a series of miscarriages, so their life was kind of ruined by these two things. I come from that milieu, you know, it was an unlucky household, really.
How did that background shape your thinking and shape your poetry? I mean, coming out of those circumstances?
It made you distrustful of the world. You thought that the bad was likely to happen, you know, and that things inevitably would go smash. I've never had an onward and upward sort of crazy optimistic view of the world, and I think it probably came out of that upbringing. But it came out of Calvinism as well, you know, the expectation that it's a nice day and we'll pay for it, you know. And I ended up Catholic, but it didn't change that undercurrent of me.
Now, you seem to be a poet who invites a certain amount of biographical scrutiny, and from what I've heard, one of the great...
I don't know why they bother. I mean, they review me sometimes rather than the poems. Oh, yeah. I figure that's only the poems that review.
Well, obviously, they're interested in your life as well. And and from what I've heard, one of the great traumas that really did shape your early life was the death of your mother when you were 12. And,
yes, poor woman. She died of being too far from hospital and a doctor who couldn't understand the kind of cultural norms of the country, you know. My father was really a 19th century man with tremendous reluctance to talk about women's intimate matter, especially with the worst gossip in the district running the telephone switch. So he was saying things like, she's having a bad turn, she's terrible sick, and the doctor couldn't understand this. He wanted to be told, she's having a miscarriage and she's bleeding to death. So the time she got to hospital, she'd bled so thoroughly that she couldn't be brought back, you know. She hung on for several days, but they couldn't bring her back to being viable. And so Dad collapsed at that point because he blamed himself. He had this terrible grief which was mixed with guilt, and he had it for the next 44 years till he died. And so I kind of lost both parents at once. Dad's addiction was to grief, you know. Huckleberry Finn's father, he had an addiction to crime and booze, but Dad had it to grief. So suddenly I was, I had to make it up by myself, you know, be my own parents.
But you wrote about that years later. I mean, obviously that experience stayed with you.
Oh, yeah. And it fed into a depression that I probably inherited from Dad and his father before him. I had depression, but I mean, every poet, nearly every poet has depression. It's common enough. I call it poet's flu. And mine just what differs is the subject matter. Mine was this kind of fear of womanhood and fear of sex because it kills you. You know, you die of miscarriages and things. And other people die of it too. You don't want to cause their death. So, and there I am living in a sort of an age of Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, sex is being advertised with the groceries every day. and having this neurosis riding on me back. So it was a bit of a tension. But I got through the depression pretty well all the way. You always keep some parts of it, but the dog never dies, but the dog gets a lot weaker.
Although I've read that you had a very long bout of depression.
It was long.
For 9 years or something like that?
Yeah, longer than that, really. I thought it had gone, but it hadn't, and it came back. I guess a lot of my bad reputation comes from poems in which I'm fighting it. You know, I'm in the midst of a waking nightmare. But...
You were writing during that period, during those
really
bad years.
I read all the way through. I said to the dog, you know, the black dog, you bastard, you make me cry, I make you sing. And I wrote a long verse novel called Freddie Neptune and a whole lot of poems during it. And then about 8 years into the depression, I came down with a liver abscess and I very nearly died of it and came back in this world. Somewhat to my surprise, and thought, oh, that's good. Now I'll find out how Freddie finishes, you know, because I was only two-thirds of the way through him. So I finished him and published him.
So the best cure to depression is nearly dying?
It helped. It helped, yeah. It's good to have a rehearsal of death because it takes away your fear of it. And you know pretty well how the moves will be.
And one of the pleasures of reading your poems is they come in all varieties. I mean, some are more serious, as we've been talking about. Some are just fun.
Yeah.
And could you read The Kitchen Grammars?
Sure. The Kitchen Grammars. The verb in a Sanskrit or Farsi or Latin or Japanese sentence most frequently comes last. As if the ingredients and spices only after collection, measure, and even preservation might get cooked. To all these cuisines, renown attaches. It's the opening of a Celtic sentence is a verb, and it was more fire than pot for us very often than ingredients. Had we not fed our severed heads on poetry, final might have been our famous starvation. Upholding cuisine for us are the French, to be counting in scores and called Gallic. In English and many more in Chinese, the verb surrounds itself, nucleus fashion, with its subjects and qualifiers. Down every slope of the wok they go to the spitting middle, to be sourced, ladled, lidded, steamed, flipped back up, becoming verbs themselves often. And the calm egg centres the meatloaf.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'd offer that as a motto of any college that wants it, actually. The calm egg centres the meatloaf.
Why did you become a poet?
Got interested. Fell in love with it. It was just towards the end of school. I mean, that was the 1950s, and all boys were expecting to go to the Third World War, and we were so tough, you know. And then when I saw some modern poetry, first of England and then of Australia, I turned right round. I thought, this is the most concentrated, effective, moving way of writing. I'd already wanted to do art of some sort, and just I couldn't paint. I knew nothing about music. But I thought, I want to do this because you can do everything at once in a smaller compass than any other way, you know. I don't have to write novels and plots and all that sort of thing. And the non-living things in a poem are as alive as the living things, and the animals are as alive as the people, and everything's got a kind of equality about it. So it appealed to me intensely, and I've been trying to do it ever since.
So it's the compactness, the conciseness that draws you to
that.
Poetry, more than prose.
Yeah, and the equality of it, the fact that everything in a poem is on level pegging to a degree. It's not a class system in a poem, or it isn't in one of mine anyway.
You have dedicated this book to the glory of God, and I know that Catholicism...
Now, there's another loner for you, I mean. It gets blamed for everything.
Now, you have several poems that deal with the religious life and religious ideas.
In this book, only one, really. It's called Church. Would you like me to read that one?
Sure. Well, I was thinking about The Blueprint. That's not about religion? About the afterlife?
It's about the sociology of religion. This one's about real religion.
Okay.
For Joseph Brodsky, who was a friend of mine, he was Jewish and he used to talk about becoming a Presbyterian. And I said, Joseph, I come from there. I warn you, let me tell you about John Calvin, you know. I'll read the poem, Church. The wish to be right has decamped in large numbers, but some come to God in hopes of being wrong. High on the end wall hangs the gospel from before he was books. All judging ends in his fix, all including his own. He rose out of Jewish, not English evolution, and he said the lamp he held aloft to the nations was Jewish. Freedom still eats freedom, justice eats justice, love, even love. One retarded man said, Church makes me want to be naughty. But naked in a muddy trench with many thousands, someone saying, the true God gives his flesh and blood. Idols demand yours off you.
Is it hard to turn your faith into poetry to write about it?
Tis hard, yeah. That was a thing that I've written about a good many times, about human sacrifice. I mean, any big system, or sometimes even quite small systems of thought, ideology, fashion, etc., is liable to demand human sacrifice, whether that we dismiss some kind of people or that we conquer somebody or something like that, you know. I abhor anything that demands human sacrifice. I figure I could only trust a God who said, look, I'll be the human sacrifice, you know. You don't have to be. Yeah. I'll give that sacrifice to you.
Well, I want to follow up then with what you call a poem about the sociology of religion, The Blueprint. Can you read that?
Okay. The Blueprint. Whatever the great religions offer, it is afterlife their people want. Heaven, paradise, higher reincarnations, together or apart. For these they will love God or butter karma. Afterlife. Wherever it already exists, people will crawl into ship's framework or suffocate in truck containers to reach it. They will conjure it down on their beaches and their pooled clay streets, inject it, marry into it. The secular withholds any obeisance that is aimed upwards. It must go declaratively down. But an accident of consciousness between two eternities of oblivion? All of us have done one of those eternities already on our ear. After the second, we require an afterlife greater and stranger than science gives us now. Life like, then unlike what mortal life has been. Blueprint 2 goes like this. Life after death, with all the difficult people away in a separate felicity.
That's a wonderful little addendum.
That's me and my father-in-law. We'd never occupy the same heaven, would we?
Les Murray's latest book of poetry is called The Biplane Houses. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Poetry Instead, program number 119A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.